And good morning or afternoon or whatever. You're back from your weekend. I assume you're back from your weekend. I actually have no idea when you're listening to this show. But let's say you're listening to it live on Monday, in which case all of the preceding applies. And we're going to talk a little bit today about some stuff that excited us over the weekend. In our second segment, there seems to be kind of a mild Twitter rebellion going on, particularly among journalists. It's, of course, led by Maggie Haberman, the Trump whisperer from the New York Times, who announced that she was taking a twiatus or a twabatical from Twitter for reasons that she explained in an op-ed piece. But then a whole bunch of other journalists have kind of chimed in and said, well, you know, we're kind of doing the same thing. It's just not really working for us the way that we thought it was going to work for us. So we'll talk to media czar David Folkenflik about that. First, we're going to talk politics. We're going to talk politics with Alexander Burns from the New York Times about the wave of progressives and people who might even be to the left of progressive who are popping up in elections around the country. And then I've left the final segment open for phone calls. We might return to that topic. We've got a couple of races in Connecticut that fit that mold, but we'll see. We'll let life unfold here. We'll see what we want to talk about in that third segment. But it'll just be you and me, phone calls, that kind of thing. All right, so let's get going with our first guest of the day. Alexander Burns, national political correspondent for the New York Times, has been trying to get a handle on this trend of young, progressive, maybe even less left of typical progressive cred candidates seeking offices, often through primaries. He's joining us now. Alexander Burns, see if you can do a better job than the fumbling setup that I just engaged in.
Well, I thought you did quite well, actually. we are sort of seeing in a number of primaries so far, and it has been mostly at the state and local level, although it started to happen at the federal level as well, these sort of moments of convulsion within the Democratic Party where it seems that, you know, particularly younger millennial liberal activists and voters are basically rejecting the guidance and instruction and traditions and expectations of the conventional Democratic Party. We saw it obviously most famously in New York City with the defeat of Joe Crowley, the fourth-ranking Democrat in the House of Representatives. But you've had really important and revealing primaries where sort of local Democratic machines have been defeated in places like Pennsylvania and Maryland. You have sort of pitched primary battles in places like Michigan and, as you mentioned, of course, Connecticut. And it's a real test of sort of this next generation in the party and how it's going to shape the party's candidates in 2018 and how it's going to build a relationship, an adversarial relationship with the party's traditional leaders.
And I guess one of the questions is, how much do you connect the dots? I mean, you could look at that Crowley race and say, well, his whole district had tipped demographically a long time ago. He seemed to be more concerned with national races, wasn't showing up for debates. There's lots of ways in which you could say, well, that's kind of sui generis. You can't necessarily look for that to replicate in other places. So then the question becomes, how many of these other candidacies are very specific to where they are, and how much, on the other hand, do they maybe constitute a network?
Well, I guess where I would attempt to square the circle there is that the conditions you described for Joe Crowley to lose are necessary but not sufficient for him to be defeated the way he was, right? That if Joe Crowley had worked really hard in that race, if he had spent a lot of money, if he had not, you know, effectively moved to the D.C. area years ago, he probably would have won that race in spite of the mood that there is in the Democratic Party. But 2 years ago and 2 years before that and 2 years before that, all of those things that we just said about Joe Crowley and not working the district very hard and being a sort of remote figure in Washington, all of those things were true, and he was not challenged, let alone defeated, right? So it seems like it takes both, that you need to have a traditional Democrat who is to some degree asleep at the switch, and you need this mood of rebellion in the party. I would point out that on the same night that Crowley was defeated by a double-digit margin, which was really staggering, a member of Congress basically next door in Brooklyn, Yvette Clark, who ran a more aggressive campaign and took her primary more seriously, was barely renominated against, again, a much younger, more liberal, more activist opponent who was running for political office for the first time. So you are seeing this happen, not just in places where Democrats are kind of asking for it, but especially in areas where it is sort of a deep blue districts and where there's a sort of political culture of deference to a political machine of a kind that we definitely have in New York City and that you have in big cities around the country.
So one of the places you looked at was Michigan. And actually, there's kind of two races in Michigan that are potentially within the framework that we're talking about. But let's first talk about the gubernatorial race.
Right. So the governor's race is the big ticket in the state this year. There's also a Senate race, but it has not heated up to the same degree. You know, Democrats have been locked out of the locked out of the governorship for 8 years, totally locked out of Michigan government because they've not even had a hand in either chamber of the legislature since the 2010 election. So this is a really, really high stakes race for Democrats in the state. And you've had this intense primary between the front runner, who's a woman named Gretchen Whitmer. She's the former Democratic leader in the state Senate and has been seen as sort of a future candidate for statewide office, governor, senator for years and years. She's running against two opponents. The one that I looked at most closely is a young man named Abdul El Sayed, who's a former director of public health in the city of Detroit. He's 33 years old, and he's running as a much more activist Democrat. He's committed to creating a single-payer system on the state level. He has campaigned in an abolish ICE shirt. He is very much a candidate in the mold of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democrat who beat Joe Crowley.
You know, one of the things that we see with a lot of these candidates is that phrase single-payer system, right? There's maybe two or three policies that kind of attach themselves pretty consistently to the kind of candidate that you're writing about. One of them has to do, I think, with immigration policy. But pretty consistently, we're seeing single-payer. Maybe you can say a little bit more about that, how consistently you saw it.
Oh, I think it is, I would say, single-payer and opposition to corporate money and politics are the two themes that I heard from basically every voter and candidate I spoke to for the story. And those are not, by the way, just preoccupations of the very left wing of the Democratic Party. The corporate money issue is an enormous preoccupation among Democrats from the sort of center left to the far left. But yeah, single payer, I think, is if there's anything that you could describe as a litmus test for your sort of hardcore progressive voter, that is it. You've seen this in gubernatorial races around the country. Ben Jealous, the Democratic nominee for governor of Maryland, campaigned very hard on single payer. Same is true for Gavin Newsom, the Democrat who's very likely to be the next governor of California. Colin, what I would say sets Abdul El Sayed apart a little bit is that he has a much more detailed plan for achieving single payer than you've seen other Democrats roll out. So this is in some ways even left of the left candidates that we've seen so far, because you know, I mentioned Gavin Newsom. He campaigned on creating single-payer. He never outlined, you know, these are the taxes I'm going to raise, these are the services I'm going to provide. It was a sort of vague commitment that liberals could latch onto if they were so inclined. In this race in Michigan, you really do have a Democrat campaigning openly saying, yeah, I'm going to raise taxes, and I'm going to use the money that's raised in order to make it so you don't have to pay health care premiums.
So one of the things that we've seen in polling is that younger voters, voters in their 20s, maybe early 30s, are much more comfortable talking about alternatives to capitalist democracy as we know it, right? They're much more comfortable with the word socialism. They're therefore much more interested in some of these candidates who might go in a more Bernie Sanders kind of direction. The question, of course, is for the Democratic Party, are there enough of them to make a difference in a primary? And then will there be enough other people to make a difference in a general election? Like how much of the nation has been brought along to this style of thinking?
Well, it's sort of an open question at this point, and we have a couple more opportunities to answer it before the end of the primary season. Michigan is one, Connecticut is another. I would point people to Florida and New York, which has its New York has its state level primaries in September because it's a confused and sort of tangled up system. But you know, I think to get to the heart of your question, you're not looking at a majority of the Democratic Party that is taking these views. You have had in congressional elections, you've had basically two candidates who come from this wing of the party nominated in the 60 most competitive House races. So you're not looking at a wall-to-wall takeover of the Democratic Party by the activist left. What you are seeing is enough of a faction in the party that takes this view. I would estimate it at a quarter to a third of the party. There are enough of them that even mainstream traditional Democratic candidates do feel pressure to run more to the left than they have in the past, that you have Democratic candidates in places like northern New Jersey or Orange County, California, or the Chicago suburbs, who have campaigned not necessarily on single payer, but on something vaguer that they, I'm sure everybody's heard the term Medicare for All, which is a sort of Rorschach test of a political slogan, that it can mean single payer to some people, it can mean a Medicare buy-in to some other people, but basically it allows people on the left to feel that this is a candidate who is accommodating them. So that's where I would say you're seeing the biggest impact so far, is in drawing the median Democratic candidate's message somewhat to the left.
I mean, the other thing that we saw in 2016, and we talked to these people at rallies, and they showed up in the polling too, are the people that I call the second choice Bernie people. So even when the Republican field was in full flower, basically nobody had dropped out yet, you could go to a Trump rally and ask people who they would like if Trump couldn't be president, and they would say Bernie, even though at that point they had choices like John Kasich and Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush and people like that. They saw Bernie as the other guy who was anti-corporatist in a way that Trump had persuaded them that he was, and was for the restoration of an economic system on behalf of the worker, as opposed to on behalf of the moneyed interest, in a way that they liked. And so when you look at it that way, and you maybe even go outside the rubric of the Democratic Party itself and talk about unaffiliated voters and maybe disgruntled Republicans, that message, positioned correctly, could be a very powerful one.
I think that's right. I think it's one of the paradoxes of the Democratic identity crisis in 2018 that, I think folks in Washington and in the media often describe the Bernie Sanders message as the more left-wing and thus less electable message. But, and that may be true as it pertains to Bernie Sanders as a personality and to the specific brand of Democratic socialism as he describes it. I don't think you're going to hear Democrats campaigning on that brand in places like West Virginia and North Dakota. But the bigger framework of messaging that you hear from folks like Bernie Sanders and candidates in his mold of going after Wall Street, going after the pharmaceutical companies, saying that politics is a rigged game, that is a message that appeals very, very broadly, and in a lot of ways more broadly than the message that Hillary Clinton delivered in 2016. Colin, where I would distinguish the voters you're describing from the sort of millennial left that I looked at in my piece, is that the younger liberals are way more culturally liberal and culturally to the left than the, I think, the sort of archetype of the Bernie Sanders Trump voter who, I met plenty of them as well, and they were, they tended to be older white folks who were, supportive of the kind of traditional labor industrial agenda that Bernie Sanders describes, and that the president certainly appeared to be sympathetic to during the campaign, though he's obviously governed really differently. Those are not necessarily voters who I suspect would be on board with something like abolish ICE, right? But they're voters who are on board with the anti-corporate money side of things.
Right. And one interesting way to kind of market test this a little bit, although it's very unscientific, is the fact that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the person who did beat Representative Crowley, and now pretty much has a layup to win the seat against minimal Republican opposition. That means that she can travel around and bring that message to other places. And a companion piece to yours was about her going places like Kansas. I mean, the problem with this is the people who are going to come to that rally, even though you're in Kansas, are going to be, the local college chapter of Our Revolution or something. I mean, you're not going to be able to put her in front of the kind of voter that we were just talking about.
No, probably not. And it is one of the traps that your sort of hardcore partisans on both sides fall into. I remember Donald Trump holding a rally in central Connecticut late in the primary season in 2016, where he got an enormous reception, right? And then he got completely destroyed in the state in the general election. We are a divided country, but the sort of red state, blue state frame doesn't account for the fact that there are a lot of Democrats in a place like Kansas, and there are even a lot of very, very liberal Democrats in a state like Kansas. There just aren't enough of them to win elections.
Right. And there, I think, are also some centrist and older Democrats, as you say, who see some of this as a kamikaze mission. They're even here in Connecticut. OK, there's Eva Bermudez Zimmerman, who's pretty much in this mold, probably a little bit more associated with unions than a lot of the people that you profiled. But she's trying to unseat the convention choice, Susan Bicewicz, for lieutenant governor. There are a lot of Democrats in the state who just are very nervous that she'll succeed at the primary stage. stage and then be kind of a problem in the general election, make it harder for the top of the ticket, Ned Lamont, to win. I think that's less true in the other race that we're looking at here in Connecticut, which is Johanna Hayes versus Mary Glassman, two Democrats seeking the nomination to take Elizabeth Estes' old seat. But, I mean, if Johanna Hayes, who, once again, straight-up, single-payer kind of candidate, if she were to win that primary, that would be a big difference between her and Elizabeth Estes, who I think does fall into the more, you know, Hillary Clinton corporatist Democrat mold that we've been talking about.
Right, and this is why, in some ways, this whole theme is more of a story about 2019 than a story about 2018, because in, as I mentioned before, in the overwhelming majority of the truly competitive general election congressional races, you're seeing the Democrats nominate pretty conventional candidates, right? But in some of the primaries for open seats in solid blue areas or in distinctly blue-colored areas like the one you just alluded to, or you know, even more the case in Queens, you are seeing Democrats who, you know, are more sort of traditional Washington Democrats get replaced or potentially get replaced by people who are way to their left. And this frankly, more than anything else, is what transformed the Republican Party over the last decade, is you would see candidates in solid red areas retire or get defeated in primaries and get replaced by people who are far, far, far more conservative and hardline in their political orientation. And it transforms a party without necessarily affecting many of the toss-up races in November.
But I will say that if Hayes wins the nomination in the 5th, that'll be an interesting one for you to watch, because that is the tippiest of the 5 congressional districts in Connecticut. It's the one where a Republican can put together a win under certain circumstances. So if Hayes tracks way to the left of a typical 5th district Democratic nominee, even though she was kind of Chris Murphy's pick to run in that particular slot, that would be it's not a layup that a Democrat will win every time in that district, and
right.
A backlash could I mean, I think it's unlikely, but there could be a backlash if she's really seen as some kind of crypto socialist.
And it is a phenomenon that we've seen in wave elections in the past, where you have candidates first nominated and then elected in the general election who are sort of objectively well to the left or the right of their district. But because it's a wave election, voters kind of look past those ideological, any ideological misgivings that they may have, right? In 2010, Republicans elected extremely conservative candidates in places like the suburbs of Chicago, right, which normally would never go for a candidate like that. So you will also see people elected on the Democratic side this year, in all likelihood, if the cycle develops as it appears to be. You'll see people elected who are really kind of ideologically out of step with the places that they represent and who will have very, very tough campaigns in 2 years.
Interesting. Well, we live in interesting times. Alexander Burns, national political correspondent for the New York Times. Check out his piece from this weekend about the coming political revolution on the left. Thanks for talking to me today, man.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed that. We're going to take a little break now. When we come back, as promised, David Folkenflik to talk about the new ambivalence towards Twitter among prominent political journalists. I would like to, before we begin this segment, apologize for Kai Rizdahling at the end of the last segment. Kai Rizdahling is when you address the male person you are interviewing as man. And the difficulty of this is that there is no corresponding way to address a female guest. For example, if I were interviewing Maggie Haberman instead of Alex Burns and I said, "That was great. Thanks a lot, girl." You know, that would be really horrible. But on the other hand, man implies this kind of familiarity, collegiality, fraternity with your male guests. So it's best not to do that at all. And so I would like to apologize for Kai Rizdahling. It won't happen again. And I promise it won't happen with our next guest, David Folkenflik. He's way too smart to let that happen anyway and way too media savvy. He's NPR's media correspondent and the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. David Folkenflik, welcome to our show.
Thanks, Colin.
So Twitter was, as it tends to be, very much in the news over the weekend, although at least in one respect, in kind of a different way. Maggie Haberman, sometimes referred to as the Trump whisperer, a person who has become more famous than the average political beat journalist tends to be, partly because of her sort of love-hate relationship with Donald Trump, but also, not incidentally, because of her tremendous presence on Twitter. Maggie Haberman announced that she was going to take a twabatical, or a twiatus, and I'm trying to get in Merriam-Webster. Anyway,
those
I can't.
New to me.
All right. So, and she said she was just going to back away from Twitter because it had become an unfriendly place. And just, I mean, I don't know, to boil her argument down, it's sort of the negatives of being on Twitter outweighed the positives. And that also kind of prompted a chorus of other journalists saying, well, everybody should read what Maggie's writing. Maybe she has a point, or, you know, I'm backing away too. And so, first of all, David, I think as you would point out, it's hard to not be on Twitter if you're going to cover the president who speaks to the world via Twitter.
Yeah, I think that it's really almost impossible to understand Trump entirely and his state of mind without following him on Twitter. And this is, I think, less important for Americans and more important for the press conveying what's happening with the president to Americans, because CBS News and The New York Times and NPR and every other little site is going to be able to follow his tweets. It's like a mood ring. And there was, you know, to underscore this point, there was a federal lawsuit brought by a handful of Twitter users who sued the president and various of his aides for blocking them from his official White House Twitter feed as president of the United States, because they said this is an official record and document. Anything the president does in that realm is a document. It's being archived at the National Archives, as well as the Library of Congress, sort of sweeping up everything on Twitter. But this is seen as a presidential official utterance, not a private declaration in which they're allowed to exchange back and forth. And so the federal judge agreed that they had the right to follow him. And this underscores the fact that this is essentially a real-time mood ring for what the president is thinking or what the president wants to be perceived as thinking or talking about. And so, it is in miniature one among many ways in which Twitter is exceptionally useful as a tool, both in terms of firsthand almost documentation of where people are coming from, and also to capture some of the conversation and debate about it. So, it's really useful to reporters, including me.
On the other hand, and not to make too much of this kind of thing, because obviously if you're reporting in Syria, you could get shot. If you're reporting in Russia, you could get locked up. But this has become a very inhospitable climate for a lot of political journalists, especially the ones who write a lot about the president. And partly that's because he encourages it. He did it during the campaign at his rallies, where he would single out, it was often a woman. There's Katie Turr, horrible Katie Turr. There's horrible Maggie Haberman. And he does it on Twitter, too. And when he does it on Twitter, it creates an environment where a journalist like Maggie Haberman will be harassed, will be subjected to quite a bit of invective. It has also been suggested that women on Twitter run into this kind of stuff more than male journalists do. And I don't know. I mean, I can certainly respect anybody like Maggie Haberman saying, for my own mental health, I have so many stressors, I need to remove this one. I don't know. What's your reaction?
Well, certainly, far be it for me to disagree with women journalists about their experiences on Twitter. I've certainly either seen or had exchanges with people, including not only Haberman, but Joan Walsh, who with The Nation used to be with Salon, Clara Jeffrey of Mother Jones, Mary Catherine Hamm, a conservative writer. There are just far too many women to count who say that they are subjected routinely not only to hostile reactions, not only to mansplaining, not only to hostile reactions, not only to angry reactions, but to actually clearly abusive reactions. And that doesn't hold only for women. My friend and former colleague Jonathan Weissman of the New York Times wrote a book about, inspired by his experiences about being a political journalist and editor subsequently at the New York Times during the 2016 cycle, and also being Jewish and experiencing what that was like. I had a small taste of that. I've experienced people tweeting Holocaust-related things at me. I happen to be Jewish. But I think that, it is a source of great utility, and it can allow people through anonymity, through just the personality of the medium, to be extraordinarily abusive and invasive. I don't think we should think that that's unique to Twitter, and I don't think we should think that's unique to the age of Donald Trump. If you talked about 4chan or other social media platforms, sometimes in the subtweets at Reddit, people can get quite abusive for each other. Not subtweets, but you know, the sub discussions happening on the site. You know, this happens in Facebook as well, but Twitter, it seems to be so public, and it's a place where public figures are personally engaging so much that even as they're reporting, analyzing, offering one-liners, whatever, somebody like Maggie Haberman, who's, you know, a pretty sharp-elbowed practitioner of Twitter, we should forget she's not, you know, a wallflower here. This is somebody who came up, her father was a prominent journalist at the New York Times, as well as the Daily News, as she had worked at the New York Post. You know, she has a bit of a, hey, I'm going to punch back if people are punching at or questioning the integrity of my journalism. And people did that from the right and left to Haberman, but she got a heck of a lot of abuse as a result.
Yeah, I think also, I'm glad you mentioned that part of it, because the other thing about Maggie Haberman, two things that have always struck me about her work on Twitter. One of them is she's also a tremendous curator on Twitter. I mean, if you just looked at Maggie Haberman's own Twitter feed, she retweets all kinds of stuff that she thinks is important. It's like she's almost a publisher. She's publishing a newspaper comprised of links of things that she thinks are really interesting, and she was really good at that. But she also was, as a lot of journalists are, David, a little bit more herself, a little bit more opinionated when on Twitter than she would be in a fully vetted New York Times column or piece or whatever. And I mean, every single news organization has all kinds of policies in which they try to spell this stuff out. But the reality is, for many, many journalists, Twitter is an area where you can at least go 10%, 20% further towards your own take on things than probably your home publication or media outlet would let you do. And that's another part of this, right? It's one of the reasons that Twitter maybe becomes a place where Maggie Haberman finds herself in arguments.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's good and bad to this, right? Not everybody has a midday talk show like you do, Colin. Mm-hmm. So not everybody has a column for years that, you know, is read by in their Metro readership in which they're allowed to engage. So not everybody can do a playful little gentle tweak of a Kai Rizdahl and have it then heard by their fellow journalists, their friends and colleagues outside the walls of their newsroom as well as inside, right? And right. So it's a way to kind of flex a muscle, release a little creativity, show a spark of life. You know, some people build brands, other people build bridges. And I think there are ways in which insights are gleaned and shared that are off the cuff, that are not worth or not able to be shared in print or online or on the air in a more formal way. But this is a way people can say, hey, this is something worth knowing. Here's a piece of context. You know, when I did stories about Tronc basically announcing it would cut the New York Daily News in half today. And I was able to add context. Actually, somebody else did it for me. And I pointed to this person of tweets I had done some months ago about the extraordinary corporate executives' compensation at Tronc, even as they're cutting the place in half. And so, you know, this is context. Is it something I would have time while talking to you and doing other stories to do an entire separate take on? No, but it's a way in which you can add value, and hundreds of people are getting to see that through that being shared, or thousands of people, who knows. So, you know, it's very, very useful. But that said, people are drawn into it. Sometimes they're drawn into fights. You find people who take issue with coverage at time, particularly a prominent journalist, getting quite angry about things. And then you find people being actually abusive, on the basis of gender or race or ethnicity, being abusive on the nature of just questioning the person's integrity to the point of, you know, questioning their humanity. And Twitter's corporate execs, Jack Dorsey, who's one of the top execs there, has tweeted about this earlier in the year and again in recent days, and tweeted about the need to figure out ways to essentially rejigger the formulas so that you're seeing stuff that are valuable to you and are not simply distractions and not simply hostilities. But it's even when it's useful, it is intentionally designed to compel you to use more and more of your free and not free time on the platform itself. It is designed to suck you in a little bit like a narcotic, or maybe not even just a little bit. And as a result, you know, Haberman's reservations, as she laid them out in the pages of her paper on Sunday, were multifold, because she said, God, am I just getting sucked into this, both the not constructive use of my time, and even constructively just seeing things in the array that Twitter would present it to me, as opposed to the way my reporting might point to.
Right. She has tweeted 187,000 times, which, you know, that would worry me. Just
holy
in terms of...
cow. That is a lot of times to be tweeting. And look, I should spend less time on it, and yet my ability to spend time on it allows me to anticipate the news before it happens. It's very useful.
So let me just flip this around in the other direction for a second, David, because I think there's another way in which journalism is challenged here. And Charlie Sykes brought it up in a piece over the weekend. Charlie Sykes, originally known as a conservative talk show host, now kind of a prominent never-Trumper conservative columnist. But, you know, there's a way in which we as journalists have fallen into the trap a little bit, not just with Trump, but with any politician or any newsmaker, of covering a tweet like it were a thing. You know, so Bob Corker tweets, "That's it. I've had it. That was a horror show there in Helsinki. We can't put up with that anymore." And then he's basically done. And then the rest of us run and cover it. Like, well, now the tide's turning. Things are really changing. And one of the things I don't think we've necessarily developed is a metric for evaluating the actual weight of a tweet. I don't think that weight is very great, you know, but there's a way in which we run and we cover the tweet. And that excuses the newsmaker from doing anything else. It's like, I tweeted, sure. They covered it, we're done.
Look, I mean, one of the things that I said at the outset of the presidency, I may have even talked about with this with you at the time in January of 2017, was the idea that every paper should find a way to dedicate some space on page 6 or 8 of the front section and say, you know, Trump's tweets today, you know, the triple T, and that you can just sort of slap it in there and then you can forget about it. It turns out that's not going to be useful enough in terms of understanding why is the North Korean dictator saying what he did. Oh, well, it turned out the president tweeted at him 6 times, you know, between the hours of 6 and 8 while watching Fox and Friends. You know, that matters. That has an effect. I do think that, you know, one of the things we've seen in recent days, as an example, are Trump's tweets about what certain court documents show about Carter Page, his former foreign policy aide, suspected by intelligence, national security officials of having been turned into a Russian asset, or at least having been, pursued by the Russians in that manner. And he said things that clearly contradicted the facts and the truth. When Reuters or the Associated Press or other news agencies put out alerts and put out tweets that say president says so-and-so and leave it unencumbered by actual validating or invalidating facts, I think that's a real disservice. I think that's a way in which the, you know, staccato kind of telegram length messages served up by Twitter sort of lull journalists at times into relaying what's been said there and alleged, particularly by this president and this administration, who often not only strays from the facts but seems totally estranged from them, in a way that I think is a disservice to their audiences. So I think it's important, even if you're following those brief utterances, to surround them with, you know, an army of the truth and an army of facts. Because I think one of the things we've learned is that when you marry a rough rhetoric and deceit, or at times misleading statements, or and NPR doesn't usually use this term, but I do at times. At times they appear to be outright lies. They have to be surrounded by truth and context. And that's one of the things Twitter can be very good at. And it's one of the things Twitter can be very bad at. It's almost as though Twitter is an amplification vehicle for our virtues and our vices all at once.
That is perfectly put, as we would expect from David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent. And I also have to say, we've been enjoying the work that you've been doing, occasionally hosting On Point.
It's been fun.
Yeah. So, David, I value you very much as a person. Thank you for joining the show today.
I value you as a person. Take care, Colin.
Okay. We're going to take a little break. We're going to come back. When we come back, there'll be no guests. That'll be just you and me. I want to revive the conversation that I had with Alex Burns at the beginning. He's talking about a way in which voters are, in some respects, attracted to some of these candidates who at least appear to track to way to the left of center. But maybe what people are really attracted to is an anti-corporatist candidate of any kind, a candidate who's promising to give the average person a leg up, some help up in trying to compete for scarce resources with corporations. So I did a very poor job of setting that up. But anyway, what are you looking for? What's important to you? If you had to make a choice, say, in the upcoming Democratic primary between a Johanna Hayes and a Mary Glassman, how would you make that choice? 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266, and we will be back.
Let him tweet, let him tweet, let him tweet, let him tweet. Texting stupid statements, let him tweet.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan, with help from me, Kyone Wolf, and our intern, Zandra Ellen. The part of Bill Curry was played by Bernie Sanders. On tomorrow's show, revisit our conversation about Connecticut dance halls and Shabu. And now, back to Colin.
Oh, this is, you know, this has been a very confusing summer for me in a lot of different ways. And one of the ways that it's been confusing, I'm just going to mention this in passing, and then I'm going to move back to the topic that I'm throwing out here to get phone calls in just a second. We have these two visiting animal scholars in our house. They've been with us since, I don't know, they must have arrived in June, right? They're still there. There's a cat named Sad Cat, and then there's a dog named Dr. Evil. And the dog, Dr. Evil, is a border collie, and he seems like a very nice dog when you first meet him, but I've discovered, and I think this might be kind of a border collie thing, I think his goal is world domination. I mean, he basically is the boss of our house, or thinks he's the boss of our house now. He's only been living here since June. He's theoretically going to be gone sometime in August. But he has basically declared himself, you know, like governor for life or something of our house. And I think he wants to take over your house, too, and then the next house, and then the next house. He wants everybody to do all of his border collie stuff. So if I seem a little jumbled, if I seem, I want you to know that I'm contending every day with a very powerful will that wants to dominate me, and that is Dr. Evil, the border collie. All right, so let's go back to the topics here. and this will tie in with David Folkenflik a little bit. James Comey. Remember when James Comey, like, didn't really have a Twitter account? Or he did, but it was like a secret one with a special name or something like that, and there was only one tweet. Well, James Comey now has his Twitter account, and here's what he tweets today, this very day, or maybe it was yesterday. Democrats, please, please don't lose your minds and rush to the socialist left. This president and his Republican Party are counting on you to do exactly that. America's great middle wants sensible, balanced, ethical leadership. So first of all, isn't that a little weird that James Comey is telling people how to vote now? I mean, he was this kind of rigorously, supposedly anti-political FBI director, except when he got really involved in politics, which happened in monumental ways. But now, now he's like really worried that we're going to vote for, you know, Eva Bermuda Zimmerman or something. We're going to lose our minds. But he is framing the question that we started the show out with in his own way. And he is not alone in that particular concern. So Representative Jim Himes, a congressman here from our own 4th District, is saying a similar thing. This is an article I happened across today where he's talking about the exact same fear. The latest irritant for him, a proposal to scrap Immigration and Customs Enforcement, otherwise known as ICE. He says it harms us in areas where we need to win, says Himes, the chairman of the 68-member New Democrat Coalition. To my progressive friends who got excited about abolish ICE, I understand the emotions, the moral vacuum that is involved in splitting up families, blah, 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 blah. I'm not going to go on reading this. But in general, his biggest problem, his concern, is a bigger concern than just ICE. He's chairman of something called the 68-member New Democrat Coalition, which I assume is kind of a current version of the old Democratic Leadership Council, kind of a centrist version of the Democratic Party. He's worried that it could blow its chance by veering too far to the left in a reaction to President Donald Trump. So that's very similar to the kind of thing that we're talking about with Alex Burns at the beginning of the show. As you look around the country, there are these candidates. They're often younger, and their supporters are often younger. And they want something different. They don't want the Democratic Party as it has existed from, at minimum, since 1992 to the present. That is the Democratic Party of, of course, another person who has been writing about this exact same thing is Joe Lieberman. Joe Lieberman was writing in the Wall Street Journal about the exact, he's very worried that Democrats are going to vote for candidates who are too far to the left. So I want to ask you how that plays with you, because it was clear in 2016, that there was an appetite, at least on parts of the Democratic Party, and also parts of the unaffiliated electorate, for if not something that tracks further to the left, at least doesn't resemble the corporatist Democratic Party that we have grown familiar with. By the way, the number is 860-275-7266 if you want in on this conversation. 860-275-7266. So as you look around the country, you can see that popping up. And I almost do think that the terminology that I've been using is the wrong terminology. That tracking to the left, for example, that may not explain it very well. Sure, when you have a younger candidate often of color, a candidate who's a woman, these are often ways of attracting a constituency that's tired of a party dominated by white males who have a kind of consistent vision of things. And then if that candidate, say, does favor the abolition of ICE and the institution of Medicare for All or some version of a more coherent healthcare reform than what we've had so far. I mean, all of that, you know, begins to sort of line up with the Bernie Sanders movement within the party. But I don't think these things are all have to be the same thing. And I don't think that saying that they track to the left is an adequate description. And I also think it is possible to appeal to a discontented voter, both within the Democratic Party, within the unaffiliated, and even within the Republican Party, because God knows there are Republicans right now who are very uncomfortable with the direction of things under President Trump. It's possible to appeal to those kinds of people in a different way, in a way that doesn't necessarily manifest itself so identifiably as the politics of the left. And, you know, I think as Alex Burns was saying, too, if you're going to run around saying that you're a socialist, you're just going to lose a certain number of people. It's not clear how many people you're going to lose. And certainly in the younger demographic, they are not afraid of that word, not the same way, say, my generation was. So I don't know if I've presented to you in a coherent, intelligible conundrum. But let's say I have. Let's pretend I have. Call 860-275-7266 and just tell me how you see those kinds of questions playing out in the current cycle. All right. As usual, we have lots of guys calling in. So it'd also be good if a woman would call in, 860-275-7266. But for now, I'm quite happy to start with Peter in Stamford. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. This is what I've thought of as a paradigm. Like the right, it thinks maybe, and this is simple, it's a very simplified version, that the right, the libertarian Ayn Rand right would look at corporations taking care of America, and the left would characterize as the government would be taking care of people. So you have, corporations versus government, and I think both have sort of failed in a way, I don't think corporations can take care of America. You know, they took care of my dad. I grew up in Greenwich, and we got a good living back in the man in the gray flannel suit days, the how to get rich in business without even trying days. Those days are over. But the government is also, it has, mild success. The government educates, 90% of the population. I think maybe we should need there's less and less workers like the 19th century Marxists would have it. But I think unions are dwindling away, and the powers of the workers, and I think this whole topic can deserve a whole couple of shows.
All right. So your point is, just very quickly, because I want to be able to get a few more callers on the air.
Sure.
Let's just go from there. I mean, I think Peter has set up the paradigm pretty well. Let's go from there to Alan. Here's Alan in Seymour. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I'm one of the young left socialists that Joe Lieberman seems to be afraid of voting.
Right.
I don't think that if it were any other year, I would vote any differently than I would this year. I'm not voting left just because I'm upset that the right's winning, and I would be voting left even if we were in a third year of Obama.
So, Alan, let me ask you a question. Do you feel as though you are currently offered choices that do map pretty well onto your desires? In other words, I think in the Sanders movement in 2016, a lot of people your age were saying, well, yeah, finally somebody's saying stuff that I believe. I haven't really been hearing that from any sector so far. How does it feel for you here in 2018?
I'm not seeing anyone that's really exciting me in the way that Sanders did, but I have been pretty happy with the nominees for governor, and I haven't been paying too much attention to the vice governor or lieutenant governor race. But
how about the do you live in the 5th district? I'm trying to think about Seymour would either catch an edge of it or just miss. Would you be voting? I'm assuming you're a registered Democrat. Would you be voting in the primary, the Glassman-Hayes primary?
I will be. All right. I believe.
So I'm guessing you're a Hayes voter, but maybe I'm completely wrong. Yes. Yeah. And yeah. Once again, she's talking about single payer, stuff like that, that's meaningful to you. All right. Well, listen, thanks for calling, Alan. I want to get to Pam in Branford. Hi, Pam. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon. I don't care. We're all in a time warp anyway.
I want to make a comment to what you said about James Comey.
Mm-hmm.
Saying not to vote too far on the left. I was a registered independent for over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And after Trump got elected, I went down and changed parties. I went over to Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
I figured they would need the help. And I have to tell you, at this point, I would vote for anybody on the Democratic side. It could be a billy goat there. And I would vote Democrat over what's going on now. And I'm a retiree, so, you know, I have really no stake in the economy at this point. I'm a retired federal employee.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's horrific what's going on now.
So,
it's terrible.
Yeah. So you're saying, though, that you're going to be a little bit less discriminating about who's offered to you as an alternative.
Right.
All right. Well, listen, thanks. First of all, thanks for making that point. You know, it's also interesting that you say that you figured that they needed help. I got an email today from somebody who was saying, I'm an unaffiliated voter. I'm upset with Trump's America. Should I register as Republican so I can vote in the primary to make sure that they, you know, pick better people or whatever? And I just wrote back and said, I don't think it's my place to advise you about this. But I think a lot of people, I'm surprised. There's a Max Rees story that's up right now saying, I'm doing this from memory, but 275,000 new registrations in Connecticut since 2016, of which he said, I think about 80,000 were Democrats, 40,000 were Republicans. But that means that I'm doing the math off the top of my head, but it seems like 150,000 of those are unaffiliated voters. And Pam, I'm amazed by that. People who don't want to vote in primaries or people who are just so committed to their unaffiliated status that they're not going to vote in primaries. I'm unsurprised by your decision, but surprised that other people would register unaffiliated.
And one other comment, you know, a lot of people on the right say, oh, there's all this hatred coming from the left. It's not hatred coming from the left. It's they're trying to make it look like we are the problem. You know what? They're the one that chose this platform. They chose this platform of sexism, racism, homophobia, xenophobia. They chose this horrifying platform. And then we're supposed to sit quietly and demurely and just accept all this? All these agendas that they have. If we rise up because we're rejecting this agenda, then we're the problem. Well, it's their platform that's the problem. It's their platform that's hatred. It's not hatred coming from the left.
It's theirs. Pam, I'm gonna have to end it there.
I understand. But I just wanted to get that point out, too, because I hear that a lot. We have Trump derangement syndrome, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It's BS. It's just manipulation.
Thank you for checking your impulse to say the actual word. I heard that happen, and I'm very grateful. Pam, you're going to be the last caller of the day. I don't dare take anybody else but Lily, David, Scott, some of the other people who called up. I'm very sorry we didn't get to you. We'll do this more often. You know, we've been doing these Monday shows where we don't have any guests and people just call up. And I really like doing it a lot. But after last week, I worried that maybe I was over-relying on this format. If you have an opinion, by the way, you can always let us know at WNPR Colin on the Twitters, at WNPR Colin, or you can email me, colin@wnpr.org. But in any case, thank you for listening today anyway, and I hope you'll enjoy what we do tomorrow.